Who is this? It was a balmy afternoon in late October 1982, when in Badger Stadium, Wisconsin, was packed to overflowing with all the football fans of that team. More than 60,000 diehard Wisconsin Badger fans had gathered to see their beloved team take on the Michigan State Wolverines, best college team there is, I think. Within a matter of minutes, it was very clear that the Wolverines were the better team. They began to take control of every aspect of the game. What was odd, however, was that as the score became more and more lopsided, there would be these sudden and repeated bursts of applause and shouts of joy from the Wisconsin fans. Even though their team was getting pummeled on the field by the Wolverines, they were smiling, they were high-fiving each other as if they were winning rather than they were losing. It made absolutely no sense to any reasonable observer. What in the world was going on in that stadium? Well, it turns out that just 70 miles away, the Milwaukee Brewers baseball team was beating the St. Louis Cardinals in Game 3 of the 1982 World Series. And many of the fans in the football stadium were listening to that baseball game on portable radios. And they were responding to events other than what they saw on the field right in front of them. To someone who didn't know the whole story, such a scene looking at that crowd would be confusing. It might even lead us to wonder about the sanity of those Badger fans. Perhaps I've read the story of Jesus' triumphal entry way too many times. But I get the sense that to the uninitiated, the scene that's played out on that road to Jerusalem is confusing. This is especially true in light of what happens just a few days later at the place of the skull, or as we call it, Golgotha. What in the world is going on this road? Why is everyone so excited and yet so ready to condemn him just a few days later? Now, like many of you, I know all the elements of the story. I know most of the major players, but as I reflect on this joyous, palm-strewing crowd that greeted Jesus that day, I wonder, are they seeing what I see? What exactly are they cheering about? And I'm not the only one wondering what all this fuss is about. Because Matthew tells us that the whole city of Jerusalem was stirred up and everyone was asking, who is this? No one save Jesus himself saw the whole picture of what was going on that day. As appreciated and as truthful as the celebratory shouts of the crowd were, they would ring hollow in just a few days. The joyous cacophony flowing onto that road around Jerusalem actually hid the real story. Because in that crowd that day, there were sinister plans afoot. The religious leaders, fearing their own lack of control and prominence, wanted that parade to stop. They were not praising God as Jesus rode into town riding on a donkey. The religious leaders knew full well, and better than most folks, the prophecy of Isaiah 62 verse 11, tell the people of Israel, look, your king is coming to you. He's humble, riding on a donkey, even a donkey's colt. Jesus was clearly making a provocative statement that day. Jesus was calling on those who were watching to be aware enough of the symbolism to make a decision. Because this whole scene is a declaration to everyone who saw it that he was the Messiah. Jesus' entire ministry, all that we know and much more that we don't know, comes down to this very point in time. Every healing, the resurrection of Lazarus, the deliverance from demons, all of his teaching are all consistent with him riding in on a donkey. You can pretend any way you want that this all was just coincidence, or that Jesus never really intended for himself to be seen as the Messiah, but the scriptures, they don't let you explain it away. Jesus is declaring that he is the Messiah. There's no other conclusion to make from this scene. Consider, if you will, the significance of the triumphal entry for all four Gospels recorded. That's a rarity. All four Gospels call on us to look past the pageantry to see the message. All four Gospels ask us to stop our shouting and our palm waving for just a moment and ask, as the crowd did, who is this? Who is this who makes the lame to walk, the blind to see, the dead to rise? Who is this whose teaching just strikes at the very center of our being? Who is this who dares to ride a colt in clear fulfillment of prophecy and declares he is the one, the chosen Messiah? The religious leaders took offense to what was unfolding right before them. They accused Jesus of blasphemy, of overstepping his rightful place. You'll remember throughout the Gospels how they like to remind people that he was just the simple son of a carpenter. He was actually a man of illegitimate birth in their minds. They saw Jesus as bold, brash, and almost certainly arrogant. Hold on a minute. Have you ever thought about that word arrogant for a minute? I looked it up. The dictionary defines arrogance as being haughty, as having too high an opinion of oneself. And most of us, we really don't appreciate anyone who's arrogant, do we? All through our lives, we meet people who consider themselves to be better than we are. The religious authorities believed Jesus was arrogant because he assumed an authority that they wouldn't give him. It's a funny thing about arrogance. You can only be arrogant if the opinion you have of yourself is wrong. Now think about that. If I claim to be the best bass fisherman in the world, I'm only arrogant if that claim is proven false. Jesus claiming to be one with the Father, of being the Messiah, is only arrogance if it's not true. I think the issue before us today isn't the truth about Jesus, but rather the religious authorities. And more importantly, our own unwillingness to accept the truth of this experience. They had all the proof they could ever want to prove the validity of Jesus' words, but they just refused to believe. They didn't want to admit that they were wrong and the crowd was right. The unwashed, uneducated masses saw the hand of God at work in Jesus, and the privileged, educated scholars failed to see it or believe it. Like that football game in Wisconsin, the religious leaders were listening to something else. And what were they listening to? They were listening to their traditions, to their grip on power. They were looking at their, or listening to their perceived authority. And it caused a complete disconnect with what was happening on that road toward Jerusalem. In their zeal to protect their externalized spirituality, they had missed the significance of the most important message Jesus sought to impart to us. When Jesus rode into Jerusalem on a donkey, when he cleared the temple, and when he refused to be silent, to silence the children who sang his praises, was he being intentionally confrontational? I believe he was. I believe wholeheartedly that Jesus was casting a bright light into the failure of externalized spirituality. You know, Philip Yancey, who I love to read, in several of his writings, likes to talk about his Bible college experience. I'm so glad I didn't go to this Bible college. Even though he's being truthful, at least from his perspective, what he portrays is not very flattering to the college he attended. Here is just a little snippet from some of his experiences. A friend of mine got called to the dean's office for wearing a coat hemmed higher than her regulation length skirt. "Joyce, what are we going to do with you?" she was told, as if she had broken one of the Ten Commandments. Another time she wore a robe down the hall of the woman's dorm with the bottom button undone of that robe, and the dean shook her head. "Joyce, how can we trust you? If you fail in a thing like this, how can God use you?" Later, that same student was working in the dean's office of the dean of women's office as Valentine's Day approached. She witnessed the bizarre scene of her boss in white gloves censoring one by one those tiny heart-shaped candies that are used as decorations at parties. "You're mine, friends forever, be my Valentine." Well, they were okay, but Cutie Pie, Hot Lips, Love Ya went right in the trash can. You know, religious leaders in Jesus' day, they were really good at making rules. They were really good at enforcing those same rules on themselves and on others. However, they fell into a dangerous trap. They began to see their reliance on rules as the only way to gain God's approval. Furthermore, their reliance on rules distracted them or kept them from more important matters like justice, mercy. Did you notice that Jesus uses some of his most vivid and harshest words to challenge this extreme spirituality of theirs, or this externalized spirituality of theirs? When Jesus rides into Jerusalem on a colt, he demonstrated his willingness to embrace all of humanity. Into this clamoring sea of humanity, many who maybe never saw the significance of this ride see him riding in now. And they embrace him. Now, Jesus may have broken the Pharisees' rules of decorum. He may have broken their rules about contact with the unwashed masses. But he demonstrated time and time again a much higher purpose. The Son of Man came to seek and to save the lost. The spirituality that the religious leaders promoted was a facade. It was like whitewashed tombs, Jesus said. True followers of God ride, walk, drive, fly into the messiness of life regardless of the cost. I'm sure no one that day had to tell Jesus what that little ride was going to cost him. The crowd shouted and waved palm branches and threw their coats on the road because there was a fresh wind blowing. Someone who claimed to be sent from God was not only willing, but was going out of his way to reach out to people. Not just the respected, rule-following people, he reached out to the worst of the worst, tax collectors and prostitutes and people who were sick. No wonder they praised him. Boy, how long had they waited for some hope, some sense that God cared for them? Comparing their lives to the high standards promoted by the religious elite, the vast majority would have despaired. I can never live up to that level of rule keeping, they would tell themselves. And faced with the daunting goal of trying to conform to the high level of rule keeping, many of them just simply to stop trying. Or they began to live a double life. Their spirituality became a matter of convenience. You appear spiritual, or at least publicly, but do whatever you want as long as no one sees you or catches you. Following Jesus is not about giving the appearance of a spiritual life. Never has been. Regardless of how long your rule book is, it doesn't matter. Following Christ means having your heart changed, not your rule book. If our hearts are not redeemed, we are nothing but whitewashed tombs. We have cleaned the outside of our bowls, but left the inside untouched. And the implications of externalized faith, they're staggering. Philip Yancey again tells of an Iranian Muslim intellectual who was visiting a Harvard professor and made the following observation. This is an Iranian Muslim, remember. These young people, meaning the people at the university, may be lost to Islam forever. They follow the conventions of Islamic dress and custom because they are required to do so by law, but inside their hearts, they are hollow and cynical. We're losing an entire generation of unbelievers in our zeal to force conformity. That was a Muslim said that. And those words about Islam could easily be said about the current generation of young people raised in the Christian church. In Jesus' day, there was a whole generation of people who were in danger of being lost to God because their hearts were hollow and they were cynical. People who were tired of the hypocrisy, were tired of the burdensome rules, and those entrusted to shepherd them had forced on them with zealousness. If there's no hope of ever connecting with God, either in this life or in the next, why in the world would I harbor hope? If it is God's will that I be poor, blind, lame, forced into an immoral lifestyle, why would I seek him out? You wouldn't. But the good news is that God came and sought us out. The lost have been found. The poor have been made rich. The blind can see. The lame can walk and the dead are raised to life. I was surprised to learn something this past week about the city of Memphis, Tennessee. You know that place? Most of the time when you hear that name, many of you would think that, oh, that's where Elvis Presley's Graceland Mansion is. You remember that. What I was pleased to learn, I'd love to see it sometime, is that in Memphis, there's also a special museum dedicated to the civil rights movement in the United States. The museum is actually constructed around the motel where Martin Luther King Jr. was assassinated. Inside the museum are all kinds of films and pictures of the violent police actions that were used against the protesters. And one of the displays is of a charred Greyhound bus burned to a crisp by an Alabama mob. The angry mob was intent on chasing away the freedom riders who were seeking to integrate transportation. As the bus burned, the angry mob held the doors closed, hoping to incinerate the young riders who were inside. Thankfully, with help from a highway patrolman, they were freed from that burning bus. The freedom riders and many others, they sought justice. They sought the right to eat, sleep, and ride wherever they wish. Martin Luther King Jr., on the day he was Kill gave his final speech. It was entitled, "I've Been to the Mountaintop." He said in part, "I may not get there with you, but I want you to know that we as a people will get to the promised land." I like to think that Jesus' ride in Jerusalem was the ultimate freedom ride. A ride to call all of us, all people out of darkness, call us all into the light of hope. And just as the freedom riders encountered resistance and hostility and violence, in the cause of Christ, we will face all of this. And eventually, that same cause cost Jesus' life. So here we are again. We're reaching that time of year like we do every year. We're hearing the familiar stories. We're launching into Holy Week. But what does that mean for us personally? Do we see the truth in Jesus' ride for our freedom? And more importantly, are we able to answer definitively that we know the answer to the world's prevailing question? Who is this? It is Jesus, the Son of God, the Lord and King. So come, Come join the chorus that resounds on the road to Jerusalem. Hosanna, blessed is he who comes in the name of the Lord.